physics at Nordita. Axel was originally from Germany and got his PhD at the University of Helsinki. And before taking up his full professorship at Nordita, he started there with a postdoc position in physics, and then went to the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, again as a postdoc, and then went back to Nordita and got an assistant professorship there before he took a chair in applied mathematics at Newcastle in England, and then went back eventually to Nordita as a full professor in physics. Axel has written hundreds of papers on astrophysical plasmas, in particular looking at how magnetic fields are generated and are structured in different scenarios, including the early universe, galactic fields, the solar dynamo, and so on. In the last couple of years, he's gotten interested in astrobiology, and he's going to talk what he finds interesting about that. And I think it's a kind of a new topic here. There haven't been very many talks on astrobiology, is that right? Okay, so let's look forward to what's about.
Thank you, Maria, for a kind introduction. I should explain one of the purposes of Nordita is to foster research in the Nordic countries. And so one of the purposes is therefore to introduce new research topics if they are newly emerging. And certainly astrobiology is such a topic. And it's therefore our responsibility really to get into this, do research in this field, and organize meetings in the Nordic countries, which we have done, to get all the researchers of the countries together and get involved in this new research topic. And that's what we've done, and that's how I myself got into that. People have warned me very early on that if I wanted to go into astrobiology, I must make sure I don't leave out the word bio, because if I leave out the word bio, I'm left with astrology, which is certainly the last thing I ever wanted to do. So we started getting into different fields throughout the literature until we came up with a particular topic that I will be talking about after an introduction about astrobiology in general. This particular topic has to do with the question of the handedness of both the amino acids and the sugars that are involved in making life. That material has a property of having a mixture of equally many right and left-handed building blocks, whereas any living material generates 100% selection towards only one of these two forms and stays like this forever. But the question, for example, include whether the handedness that we have in all the building blocks are a prerequisite for life that could have been imprinted from external factors, which include polarized light sources from neutron stars, or the electric force, which really makes a very small effect, or magnetic fields, perhaps. If it's a prerequisite, then these additional factors would be necessary in order to assemble these building blocks for life. On the other hand, it is also conceivable that the building, the handedness, has been imprinted or has been generated spontaneously, and that's in fact what I will be proposing here, has been generated spontaneously as a result of a bifurcation process, but a result of an instability which has either the right-handed or left-handed solutions as possible solutions. Having said this, there is a question, could it be different on different worlds, or perhaps different even on different places on Earth? And so this opens up the possibility of investigating how handedness could spread in space, not just in your test tube. But astrobiology really took off only in the last few years. And there are two very important factors which have contributed to this. On the one hand, it's the exciting discovery of new exosolar planets. Exoplanets, as they are sometimes called, they are planets around other stars. Stars different from the Earth, often quite far away, And by now we have observed something on the order of 136 different systems which harbor either one or several of these planets. What is shown here is simply just a lineup of all these different observed sources or different systems. And what is plotted here is the orbital semi-major axis in astronomical units. One astronomical unit is the distance that the Earth is away from the Sun, approximately here. And we have planets which are therefore of the same distance, at the same similar distance as the Earth is. But there's many other planets which are much further away or much closer by. In fact, some of these, the first ones that have been observed and discovered have actually happened very close by. That is a selection effect. They are much easier to see. And the way how you observe this is through the modulation of the proper motion of the central star. So the central star is spinning about the current center of gravity, which is not the center of the star because of the planet.
So what's the
value of axis in the diagram? This is just an ordering. They are ordered.
Order
the there's not otherwise nothing else behind it, no. Now the other important ingredient which made astrobiology such an exciting topic over the last few years is the fact that we have realized how diverse life can be. And life can thrive under rather extreme conditions, which we haven't thought was possible by the time, for example, when the Viking invaders landed on Mars. At that time, we were rather ignorant and thought of life forms being in a much more usual way that we are thinking of. But now we begin to believe that maybe life can still exist. Perhaps on Mars or could most certainly have existed at some point when Mars had liquid water on the surface. This is another realization that people have come about. Now, extreme life forms are observed in extreme cases on Earth. If, for example, you see the famous submersible Alvin, as it for the first time was exploring the bottom of the ocean and found as one of the major surprises life forms, and another thing were these very famous black smokers, as you see them here. They can have temperatures on the order of above 100 centigrade. And they are still not boiling because the pressures are so extremely high. Now, under these temperatures, life has been observed. And the highest temperature at which life has been seen so far is 121 centigrade. That's the record at the moment. And that's very exciting because it means that life can have thrived under a rather broad range of circumstances. Now, when did it all begin?
Just for your last slide,
yeah.
Is it known whether any of these planets are non-gaseous?
No, it's not known. One hardly has any information about their gases, their atmospheres. In one case, there was a report about hiding amounts of sodium in the atmosphere, but otherwise, I don't think there's really any more detailed information about the content in the atmosphere.
As I understand it, they're all producing some atmosphere above or thereabouts.
Not all of them.
Yes.
In fact, that was indeed the observation in the first almost 100 exoplanets that have been observed. But in fact, there can be solar mass, Earth mass planets, and they also can have Earth distances. And they can also have eccentricities which are small. Many of them have large eccentricities, but some of them have smaller eccentricities.
Yeah, so is it known that if it's Earth-like mass, that it has to be a terrestrial planet? Is that reason to think that?
It would be possible to think that, yeah. But, we should really be careful because projecting from our own solar system, we have realized many times, it's a fatal mistake, of course. The things can be very different sometimes. Sorry, since I forgot. So when did it all begin? And here's a rough timeline. T0 is the time when we believe the Earth and the Sun has, the solar system has been generated. And that's at a time that is on the order of the Hubble time. The Hubble time is 14 billion years ago, that is 1.4 times 10 to the 10th years. So, but it has existed for something on the order of 5.6, so roughly speaking, T0 will be 10 to the 10th years. That's a rather long time by comparison, even by comparison with the moment when first life appeared. In the beginning, when the solar system was formed, things happened very quickly. At T0, the initial instability began, something like a gene instability, which led to a collapse. This was initiated by the external turbulence, which leads to local overpressures, and eventually to supercriticality and a collapse. So once the collapse occurs, you generate a disk. Some of the material falls directly into the star, but a lot of material has excess angular momentum that it cannot get rid of, and it has to accumulate in an orbit around the around the newly forming star, which has not ignited as yet. As the material is in the disk, there must be a moment when planets would eventually form. The disks are initially rather hot, on the order of 3,000 Kelvin. But eventually the disks begin to cool, they begin to condensate. Small planetesimals made, that is small dust particles, they start off with sizes on the order of micron, but then eventually they get obtain sizes on the order of kilometers. That's the range when they are still being called planetesimals. Some people believe that the accumulation of planetesimals leads eventually to the formation of planets. There are other scenarios. And indeed, the truth is really not known as to how we really make planets. But eventually, the sun ignites, and the planets must be made mostly in place by that time. And that's at the time of 10 to the 6 years. And then there's a long period when there is still the gas disappearing gradually, and the disk gets cooler, and the planets eventually begin to cool down. There's an intense phase up until the moment almost when life has been recognized or detected in fossil records, for example. There must have been an extended period of time when the Earth was rather inhospitable, in the sense that a lot of meteoric and cometary impacts had occurred on the Sun, on the Earth, making the Earth a rather hot place. And if life has been generated, which is a possibility, it must have been wiped out perhaps more than once. And then there was a time, 10 to 9 years approximately, which, if you count backwards, which is approximately 3.8 billion years ago, when the first life must have stayed fixed and was never wiped out after that again. This is another amazing fact, because there are certain types of genes that can actually be traced back to a so-called universal last common ancestor. And this indicates that the life that we have here, that we have currently on Earth, really only emerged once and not is not a combination of different separate events. On the other hand, it was an event that happened very quickly after it was possible to have hospitable conditions on the Earth. Here you see the rest of the timeline, the time between 4.6 billion years ago, which is the time when the solar system was formed, until 4 billion years ago is called the Hadean. That's the time when there was a lot of lava on the surface of the Sun, of the Earth. But then, at approximately this time, the Earth's surface cooled down sufficiently. Water must have been delivered, possibly through comets, and you would have oceans. And perhaps at the very bottom of these oceans would be one possibility of coming up with making new life forms. Another possibility is to do it in the atmosphere. Yes?
Can I ask on that slide that you just got? It says that the first isotopic evidence for life is back at 3.8 billion years. What is that evidence?
This has to do, and I will show that also, you look at the, I think that is indeed the next slide here. What you do is you look at the amount of carbon 13 isotopes relative to carbon 12. And carbon 12 is lighter, slightly lighter than carbon 13. And life, we know, prefers the slightly lighter form. It has to do with the capillary properties of molecules involving carbon 12 as opposed to carbon 13, which favors this carbon 12 in processing this particular carbon through its own cycle by generating sugar. So immediately when life has formed, it begins to put the ratio of carbon 13 to carbon 12 out of equilibrium. Material that a carbon that is not of organic origin, but of carbonic origin, does not do that. He has shown the ratio, the excess of carbon 13, which is negative for organic carbon, and it's fairly much the same, fairly constant throughout the entire history, up until 3.8 billion years ago. By comparison, carbonic carbon doesn't show that excess. So the carbon that has been processed through life has been put out of equilibrium. And this is an important piece of evidence which suggests that a lot of the carbon that we have on Earth has been recycled in such an extreme way to put it out of equilibrium very early on. It is also interesting to note that a lot of energy, of course, was available for doing that. Most of the energy could have come from the solar energy. In fact, we know that in order to sustain this kind of equilibrium, what one would need is an amount of chemical energy which would correspond to something on the order of 270 milliwatts per square meter. That is the energy that is required in order to generate the chemical energy in the form of sugar. That's what you see in your, if you buy sugar in the store, you see the result in calories or joule if you're lucky. That's exactly the amount that is being produced through photosynthesis. And this is a huge amount. It is more important, larger than the amount that is otherwise available through internal energy that could be, for example, liberated in hydrothermal vents. And so some people believe that the Earth really was put out of equilibrium through photosynthesis at a very early time on. And that's the time when oxygen was generated. Through this reaction, a lot of oxygen was absorbed in the oceans, and it was only something like on the order of 2 billion years ago that oxygen made it up into the atmosphere.
How far back can you trace the
This really goes back to 2.8 billion years ago, and here are some rocks from the Ishuar rock in Greenland, which date back to close to 4 billion.
I actually ask, how far back can you trace the Homo Karnaki in the fossil record?
We can't really. There's no way of tracing back the Karnaki.
Well, up to a certain million years ago.
No. The problem is this. Once life has died, there's a process of spontaneous, as it's called, blastemization. And so the handedness disappears spontaneously. After something on a time scale of 10 to 6 years, if things are under reasonable conditions, but if it's warm, for example, it can be even shorter. This is, by the way, a method also of dating dead material. But now I come to the question of the handedness. Handedness really has to do with the carbon atom, which has two different binding sites, and if if all the four binding sites are different from each other, there is a possibility of rearranging things in exactly the opposite sense, as is shown here, and these two different molecules would be chemically different. And many other aspects, of course, are similar, but there are some aspects which are remarkably different between the two different forms. And it is a remarkable reaction, which, of course, you check this by putting it in an analyzer, by sending, first of all, mixed light through a polarizer, and you measure afterwards that the polarization plane has twisted by a certain amount, which depends on the concentration itself. But it is remarkable that given that the ingredients in this reaction are extremely simple, what we are talking about is just the reaction of water and carbon dioxide. And this generates sugar and oxygen. So there's no handedness in the ingredients of the carbon here. And for some reason, the handedness must have all of a sudden spontaneously emerged, and only in one direction, not the other direction. And of course, the reason why this is possible is because in order to accomplish such a reaction, we have to have the important factor of chlorophyll, which is an enzyme which is responsible for this reaction to be positive. This, by the way, is the reaction here for in the context of chemical energy that is being used in the black smokers, for example. The issue of handedness can be rather devastating in some cases, as it was, as is evidenced by the example, historic example of the Contagan drug that was used and prescribed in the early 60s as a sleeping pill and was supposed to cure so-called morning sickness during pregnancy. And this molecule, if it is right-handed, would have perfectly done this job. But at the time when the drug was being sold, it turned out to be much, much cheaper to, in the production to allow for both handednesses to be produced. And in fact, the so-called left-handed drug is a drug which has caused serious misformations in newborn babies. Of course, this was the time when I was born. My mother has told me several times that we were really lucky that I'm not one of them. But many of the children at my age have, unfortunately, bad history and suffer from this for the rest of their lives. Now, how does the chirality could have possibly come into being? One of the proposals for making life, or for early life, is the so-called RNA world. The RNA world is a world where both the autocatalytic properties of the RNA are being used in order to recognize and to regenerate more of its own, but also to store information. In the current world, we are not living in a pure RNA world, we are living in a so-called dual world, where the catalytic reactions are not being done by the RNA, although it is in fact possible to do that, but they are more efficiently done by proteins. And proteins are being generated by RNA, certain type of RNA, and that in turn can regenerate more RNA. So, on the other hand, RNA is a molecule. First of all, it's a complicated molecule. Secondly, it's a molecule that involves the sugar. A ribose sugar with 5 carbon atoms, and in fact, a phosphorus binding on one of the atoms. It's a very complicated molecule, and it is a molecule that has a handedness. And the handedness of these RNA molecules is right-handed. And so, obviously, if we are in an RNA world, the question of handedness must have been decided already. And so we have to look at a moment prior to the RNA world where possibly life could have originated in a way where the chirality could be self-determined. And there is, in fact, another much, much simpler molecule which takes very much the same role as RNA, and that's called PNA, which stands for peptide nucleic acids. And I will show the formula in a moment. But peptide nucleic acids have interesting properties, among them the property of electrically conducting currents. And these are the properties that are being used in some attempts to make artificial life. Artificial life is being proposed and tried in a lab in Los Alamos, but many places around the world people are trying different methods to make artificial life. For various purposes. It's not necessarily in order to understand how our life has generated or come about, but in order to really perhaps use artificial life for new engineering purposes. The electric properties are being used in the context of lipids, oily bubbles, which would lead to a compartmentalization of the molecules, which is a very important aspect. Only then you are able to have the concentrations that you need in order to accomplish any of the anticipated chemical reactions. But secondly, these oily bubbles can grow. They can absorb more soaps or amphiphiles, as they're also being called, and can grow through that process. And they can also split. And in order to do the splitting, it has been realized that the electric properties, electrically conducting properties of the PNM molecule are actually useful. Secondly, they actually tend to line up with the surface in such a way that it actually favors the splitting of these molecules. Now, these are the ideas have been only worked out in some aspects, but not in complete detail have they been proven yet. But there's a detailed and very long paper on this aspect. Now, the idea now is to have something like an RNA world, which is already able to replicate itself very much through its own autocatalytic properties, which the PNA molecule would have very much like the RNA world molecule. But it could be, at the first instance, an achiral molecule. And this is possible because PNA does not rely on this very complicated ribose backbone, which has necessarily a handedness, but it can be a backbone that is much simpler and can consist of peptides. Peptides are amino acids or chains of amino acids. He has shown the simplest amino acid, which is glycine. Glycine is an achiral molecule because the orbitals have are symmetric. Here are two H's, hydrogens on the carbon, so this one cannot be chiral. Here are two oxygens on it. You can make a dimer of this by removing water to OH from here and another H from here. Then you have a dimer, which is called a dipeptide. You can continue to polymerize this. And then you can put your base pairs very much on exactly the same base pairs that you used in RNA. Any of these four base pairs, which have the abbreviations A, U or T, G and C, you can hook up onto this DNA molecule. And there's no chirality associated with that. Through some process of genetic selection, it is conceivable that then at some point you may have turned the achiral world into a chiral world of any handedness. Arbitrary handedness. Here in this case is shown an example of the so-called alanine amino acid, where one of the H's is simply being replaced by CH3. You have the other H right here. So that's PNA, and PNA can be achiral, but it can also be in a more sophisticated form, a chiral one. So that's the environment, one possible environment that one could apply the concept of making chirality selection work. This does not exclude necessarily that the same mechanism may not also work for other mechanisms or other molecules. Some people, for example, talk about the idea of a so-called protein world, where you would not have RNA at all, but life would really just begin as proteins. This is indeed another possibility discussed by some people. Now, in order to come up with an explicit model, let me discuss a few experiments that are necessary or important in understanding the rules of the game. One is the following. And in order to do that, you need to measure what kind of polymers you have generated. In order to do that, you put your material through a mass chromatogram, yes, that's good. High performance color chromatogram, and you see basically a histogram of the masses. And the result of this is shown here. So this is your histogram, where unfortunately the left hand border has been cut off, so it doesn't matter. And you see that many of the polymers have rather short lengths, on the order of 4, 5, and 6, and they go all the way to 20 in one particular case. The way how this polymerization has been accomplished is through so-called template-directed polymerization or polychromerization, which is the same thing for shorter polymers. In order to do that, you start off with a background of right-handedness, dextro-rotary, using a base which is silane. And then you have the complementary base on your DNA molecule, which is guanine, but also right-handed. And so this leads to a polymerization process. If you only have these as monomers available, this leads to a polymerization process that is very effective and very to be able to generate polymers on the length of the length of 20 approximately. Now, if you put into the solution a monomers of the opposite handedness together with those of the right handedness, here is shown the example of adding left-handed ones in addition to the right-handed ones, you terminate the polymerization process. And what this means is that if you have a competition between both adding left and right-handed ones, you are poisoning further polymerization. And this process is a famous one, and it's called enantiomeric cross inhibition. And this is one of the built ingredients into a model that needs to be taken into account. Another example, which also emphasizes the importance of competition, is an example which comes from crystallization experiments, which is a very different experiment, not having to do anything with molecules, but with crystals, which can also have handedness. You grow a crystal, you measure which handedness it has. The easiest way to let any crystal grow is by allowing the bassin in which you do the crystallization to be at rest. And once it's at rest, you are very successful in making anything grow. And then you measure the handedness you have on each of the crystals. You measure in a solution, for example, 30 crystals, 15 have right-handed and 15 have left-handed. So on the average, you have no excess of handedness, as is shown here in this result where you show the distribution between minus and plus, that's the normalized handedness, and the amount of such experiments, that's the histogram. On the other hand, if you do the same experiment under the influence of external stirring, in that case you have a very strong competition. Basically, no crystal will ever have a chance in growing until one nucleation site is just by chance strong enough to be successful in growing large enough so that the stirring can no longer remove it again. And once this has happened, this one nucleation site can trigger the growth of other polymer, of other crystals. And so in the end, you end up with an experiment where you have either everything right-handed or either everything left-handed. And so it is the importance of a competition which has primarily the result of killing almost everybody, and only the strongest ones will survive. So this is, again, very much the same phenomenon as this enantiomeric cross-inhibition I mentioned before. Enantiomeric refers to handedness, and cross-inhibition refers to killing the other guy from the other hand. Finally, there's the aspect of catalysis, autocatalysis in this case, and autocatalysis has not been directly observed in RNA. People are hopeful that it may occur, but people have been able to see that in more idealized experiments, biochemical experiments, where you generate a dimerization, monomers and monomers being attached to each other. And those experiments are all fairly recent. So there's hope that there will be much more progress in the next few years. Here's another paper. John of Lassman, 2004. So a lot of activity in that game. But the basic idea of explaining chirality as a result of a bifurcation process has the roots very, very early on. In an early paper by Frank, 1953, where he basically ad hoc came up with artificial models which describe the rate of change, E by T, of right-handed or left-handed monomers, where you allow for the growth of the same handedness, but you have the corresponding
quenching factor from the opposite tendencies. So these models are pretty artificial, and it goes even until the very recent past that people have been trying to do these models. There's no connection with any chemistry at this point. And that's the reason why we have been trying to generate more realistic models. This would be the result of one of the models that we have been generating, which are different, but by and large show very similar bifurcation properties. What is shown here in these pictures is the amount of right-handed, here it has been denoted by X, or left-handed ones, and these are phase space trajectories. The solution where right and left-hand are equally many is always a solution, but it is an unstable solution, and eventually you run into one of the two fixed points, which are purely right or purely left-handed. But let me explain how this polymerization model works. You start by proposing reactions, and the reactions here are those where you operate with the same handedness. In this particular case, on the next one you have opposite handedness. The reaction where it's the same handedness is proportional to a certain reaction coefficient. There's a factor of 2 because you have reaction on two ends of the polymer as a possibility. The production of the target is proportional to the concentrations of the two ingredients times the reaction coefficient, and you have corresponding loss terms for the two from the two ingredients, which are the monomers and the previous polymer. You can add these two equations together into one equation, so this equation looks like this, where you have a difference between the lengths of the current polymer and the previous one. Such a solution immediately results in a remarkable property in that this equation for the histogram or for the concentration of a polymer describes the wave-like behavior. What this means is you start off generating a polymer with a certain length, and you sustain the amount of monomers all the time by some mechanism, and you measure histograms in the next few reaction cycles. And what you will find is you generate longer and longer polymers, so you will have a bump in the concentration. This bump will travel to the right. So you have a wave-like propagation, and that is something that is perhaps not easy to measure, but it's, in theory, it should be, or in practice, it should be possible to measure by doing experiments very much like in crime labs, where you measure, of course, the DNA sequences. You have to sustain this process by supplying new monomers. The monomers are being supplied from a substrate, so the substrate suffers, therefore, a corresponding loss. But the generation of new monomers must be proportional to the amount of the concentration of the substrate and to the catalytic properties, which is here assumed to be a function of the concentration of the longest polymer of the same handedness. And this is an arbitrary step, but it's one which can be measured directly and has, for example, in the dimerization process that I mentioned, measured before, has been possible to quantify directly. There's still some arbitrariness as far as the detailed functional dependence is concerned, so we have possibly different possibilities here. So here's shown the solution in the so-called racemic case where you have equally many right and left-handed building blocks. And this is the solution where you are not generating any excess handedness, and in fact, most of the polymers have a very, very short length, so the probability of having any longer ones decreases exponentially fast. And note that this is an exponential plot. But this solution is unstable. So you can perturb the solution slightly. So this is shown down here, where I stop the animation, and there's two solutions, the right-handed and left-handed ones superimposed, and you run this for longer, and the system eventually loses stability, and you have only one of the two handednesses. In order for this to work, you have, of course, a couple now of right and left-handed building blocks. You have the corresponding reaction, which allows us to have enantiomeric cross-inhibition. So this is measured by the factor Kr, I for inhibition. If you put this factor to zero, it turns out that the instability will disappear. And so clearly, the very fact that cross inhibition does exist is an important building block, an important ingredient for obtaining instability. This instability depends on, let me think here, was, depends very much on the, it depends very much on the quality of the so-called fidelity of this reaction, so that acts as a bifurcation parameter, and you can generate the usual bifurcation diagrams. Now, where should all of this actually work on Earth? There are various proposals, and we don't really know where it should happen, and perhaps any of these may potentially work as possible environments where this could happen. Here is shown the proposal by Lerman and Tang, where he proposes that bubbles, aerosol droplets from the ocean, can survive in the ocean for very long periods of time. If they are sufficiently small, they can go up high into the atmosphere, they can recycle several times, can through the clouds, very much like particles in period that are being growing in size during a hailstorm, for example. They're also recycling up to 30 times through this. That's what he is proposing as a possibility of a cell container in which you can possibly envisage these reactions to happen. Another possibility are, of course, the hydrothermal vents, where they are shown here. Hydrothermal vents have the property of having a highly porous structure, which may also allow, therefore, something like a cellular structure being available from the pores in that medium. Now, the other interesting fact with hydrothermal vents is the following. In order to drive this system, you need to put in energy. Without energy, it wouldn't work because it would be an uphill reaction. And so this has long been realized, and of course, in medicine, we know in order to make more DNA, you do this very famous polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. So you start with a very small amount of DNA, can also be RNA, and you are warming it up, so the RNA, the DNA splits up into a double strand. You warm it up a little bit more, so the other ends all. Well, so you have these two separate strands. They are now amenable to further template-directed polymerization. So you now reduce the temperature again. That's between 100 centigrade and 50 centigrade. That's regularly being done in the laboratories for the hospitals, for example. So you reduce the temperature again, and you polymerize with new monomers that you have in the solution. So by this time, you have doubled the DNA on both strands, so you have now two strands, and you can repeat this process again, making it warmer again, dissociate, and cool it down again. And this could happen naturally in real world, and particularly in these hydrothermal vents. One possibility that has been investigated by Richard Blaise is the possibility of using tidal cycles. Let me remind you that in the very early Earth, of course, the Moon was very much closer to the Earth, and the frequency of tidal cycles was probably as short as 4 hours. And so we may have had a change not only just of the temperature, but also of the concentration in shallow oceans, perhaps, or perhaps also deeper down, where the concentration changed in a regular fashion. Another possibility is near hydrothermal vents, where you have natural convection flows which circulate, in particular through these forest regions, which may lead to regular melting or dissociation of the DNA and recombination. So these are possible sites where this could happen. Now, for the last few minutes.
The property that's unique to life that you find the chirality in, is there any evidence that these porous structures could have some chirality themselves?
Oh, the porous structures don't have chirality, no. They would just propose that allow us to have a container where we would simulate what is important for allowing the high enough concentrations to occur, which could either be a cell, protocell, could be a an oil droplet, for example, could also be a water droplet, as in the other example, or could simply be a pores within in the surrounding of the Henderson lens. So that's why I mentioned that. But the chirality really is a result of an instability where the two ingredients, remember, are necessary. One is internet cross inhibition, which is a competition between right and left, and the other one is generating constantly new and new monomers. So this is a process that we would need in any case, and I'm now looking for possible places where this could happen.
Can you say that chirality is a unique property of?
That would be a unique property, provided that we can explain all the catalytic behavior, which is quite natural, and that we also believe in cross inhibition. It may not necessarily be cross inhibition, but in any case, it would be some kind of a competition, and that would be the unique aspect that is required in the case. Yes. Okay. Now, in the last few, this was actually one of the slides I wanted to show you, that how the bifurcation process could look like once you exceed a certain that degree of fidelity being 100% means that we have no crosstalk in the catalytic properties of generating new monomers. If there is some crosstalk, we have only finite chirality, and we would lose eventually the property of catalytic bifurcation. More simplified models can be generated of the form that I showed already in the beginning of this talk by ignoring higher monomers. This is very much like a game, only of course where we want to understand the basic nature of these equations. So we neglect, for example, higher polymers. We only allow dimers to form, and in the time derivative of the dimers, that is a process that adjusts rapidly. You can eliminate highly rapidly adjusting variables adiabatically and remove the time derivative, in which case you can solve for this system and have simply only a single ODE for the right-handed building blocks and the corresponding one for the left-handed building blocks. You can allow for an initial bias to occur if, for example, you do have initial a tendency to favor right as opposed to left. If that occurs, the bifurcation curve is slightly being skewed, and it looks like this. It's very much like a process where you generate a magnetic field, but you do it on the Earth, where you have the Earth's magnetic field as a background, and this will give a bias to the direction in which the magnetic field will operate. I mentioned in the very beginning that eventually you have to ask the question, how can things spread out over the Earth spatially? And here is shown an example of a very different character. This is the spreading of the Black Death through Europe in the 1300s. Here I've shown the fronts of how the Black Death propagated throughout Europe at the time. And this can be modeled very successfully in terms of a diffusion reaction, so-called reaction diffusion equation. You have a reaction which leads to an exponential growth of your illness, and a diffusion term. And unlike usual diffusion equations, which are not reactive, where the diffusion front propagates very, very slowly and only by t to the minus 1/2, in the case of a reactive diffusion front, the propagation is linear in time. And so it's very much like a wave-like propagation of the front, whose speed c is equal to the square root of the exponential growth rate, factor lambda, that would be in here, times the diffusivity constant. So this is a well-known property, which is also shared by a number of more complicated equations, including our equation, where we have added to the previous model the two diffusion terms. But this system is different in that we have not just the Black Death, we have also a difference between right-handed Black Deaths and left-handed Black Deaths, so to speak. And this leads to a new aspect, as is shown in here. Here we show a space-time diagram of the propagation of fronts of right-handed Black Death, so to speak, which propagates at a constant propagation speed. You may have had a different nucleation site where the life of opposite handedness has been generated. Again, it leads to front propagation at a constant speed. But eventually, these two fronts come into contact. And then, the trunk cannot go anywhere. Now, what would happen on the Earth if you have these two trunks? Eventually, the system would come to a complete halt, and there would be no way of having complete chirality. We would always be stuck with, and here's shown an animation of this, we would always be stuck with one particular endedness. What is shown here is, in a two-dimensional diagram, the concentration of right-handed ones, which is very low here, but then the left-handed ones is very high in the same area. These fronts propagate, and they propagate typically in such a way that the curvature begins to shrink. So the front moves in the direction of the curvature. And why is this? Let me show this in the next plot here. So here's shown such a small island. What is shown here is a particular quantity that is relevant to this quantity, the integral of this quantity. This is a quantity that determines the change of the anti-symmetric part of this equation. So you can generate or rewrite these equations in terms of a symmetric part, R plus L. That gives you a very trivial, rapid adjustment so that S is either plus or minus 1. But the anti-symmetric part follows this simple equation. If you integrate over space, the diffusion term drops out, and you're left with this term, which is this integral here, where I have put S equal to 1, in which case 2 minus 1 gives 1. Now this property, this quantity, will always be 0 if A is either plus or minus. So inside or outside the bubble, this integral is always 0. And the front, or there will be no change to the integral from outside or inside. The only contribution can come from the front. And in the front, there's this additional factor A. This quantity will be either positive or negative just before or after the front. If you integrate over this, you will find equally many contributions from these two sides, and the result will basically be 0. That's why a linear front does not propagate anymore. The result is strictly 0. The only reason why this result is not quite 0 is because the front is curved. And so you measure the length of the inner front, which is shorter than the length of the outer front, and therefore the outer front will win. And that's the reason why the front will move inwards, and it will move inwards at a constant speed. It will move at a constant speed, and that means that the speed moves only piecewise, linearly, and the number of the slope, the amount of the slope, depends on the topological amount of closed regions. It's a very simple and nice result. However, if you want to apply it to a real phenomenon, you must also allow for more complicated flows. Here is shown one such example of a flow which is turbulent. So in this case, we are talking about an advection-diffusion-reaction equation, which leads to much more complicated behavior than the simple diffusion case. Here, both cases are shown in three dimensions. And so, in effect, we have to substitute the molecular diffusion constant by a turbulent diffusion constant, which leads to changes in the adjustments of the chirality. Here is shown the excess chirality, the time derivative of this, which is approximately a constant, as a function of the diffusivity. And so it's shown here that the amount of adjustment is independent of the molecular properties once you have turbulence. But once you have, if you don't have turbulence, it depends on the resistive time scale, which can be extremely long for molecular phenomena. We argue, therefore, that the turbulence was an essential factor in order to lead to equilibration of the two handednesses throughout space. In the deep ocean, for example, you may have had circumstances where you have a lot of quiescent flows, there's not very much vertical mixing, and therefore very long time scales can be possible. And perhaps we can have a situation where right and left-handed light can have coexisted for quite some time. Let me finally say one or two words about the way how you have done these fully three-dimensional simulations. This is the code that we have developed for a number of very different circumstances, not just a question of chirality, but also just hydromagnetic turbulence in shearing boxes or in embedded boxes where you have a sphere embedded in a box. Also stratified convection, for example, or Taylor Couette flows, as is shown here, for example. This is a code which works very efficiently on an array of Linux clusters. Shem distributed memory machines can even work across the different countries using, instead of MPI, of message passing interface, the so-called PAX MPI, which is a very powerful tool. And the code scales is extremely early. So let me conclude here by saying that the polarization model that we have developed here is based on quantities that can explicitly be measured in the laboratory. So it's no longer really an artificial model. It predicts, in particular, wave-like propagation of the histograms, which in these histograms we can measure, of course, in chromatograms. The reduced model, where we reduce from an array of polymers to just two equations, we can explore quite easily the propagation of chirality throughout space. And we have seen that this process can be extremely slow if there's no turbulence. Even if there's weak turbulence in the bottom of the ocean, one can possibly have time scales as long as 500 megayears, over which different entities might have had coexisted on Earth. We don't know whether there's any way of getting evidence for this. You raised already the question whether there could be anything like fossil evidence. At the moment, there's no such way of determining this, but it's perhaps important to keep that in mind. And finally, this may be of more general interest to a range of people. We have this publicly available code, which can be used for a number of different circumstances quite efficiently whenever one has a multidimensional, or some zero-dimensional partial differential equation, multidimensional, of course, and it's useful. So that's all I wanted to say. I hope I have told you a little bit about how astrobiology can actually turn into real science. It's not just talking always, as many of the papers are. Many of the papers have no equations and just have text in it. Very difficult to understand as an outsider. But there are a few papers which have a little bit of mathematics in it. And that's interesting to read. And it's also interesting to get exposed to a completely different type of vocabulary, of course. Thank you very much.
Oh, what are some questions? In the 80s, one of the groups that were writing this autocatalytic reactions by Henry Puddy, they had a very flamboyant claim that even the weak interaction energy difference would be sufficient to shift the reaction. I find it hard to believe.
It's just certainly very hard to believe. I don't believe that. Certainly because of the fact that any thermal dynamic fluctuation will be always much, much stronger than this 10 to the minus 17, which you would have from the electric force. So it is certainly a factor, but it's completely unimportant relative to the thermal fluctuation that you would have anyway. It is, however, remarkable that amino acids have been observed in a number of meteorites, some of which are racemic. We have an equal amount of left and right-handed ones, some of which are, however, not. Those that are not are perhaps amenable to contamination. There's a systematic difference between those that are racemic and those that are not. And this may be an argument why that is perhaps due to contamination, but the amount that has been seen in excess is typically things like 20%. It's amazing. It's difficult to understand that. It should be clarified. So perhaps Kotler's light may not be completely out of question.
In the simulation you have, the deep black and white regions, if you run them long enough, do they eventually become completely black or completely white?
That's right. That's right. So that means eventually all of the Earth. So we are thinking of a time when we are about to make an RNA world. So in the beginning, we have an RNA world in some parts of the Earth, but in other parts, we may have had also success in making an RNA world, but possibly of the opposite tendencies. Possibly of the same one, but possibly of the opposite tendencies. If this is the case, then we are saying this can have coexisted for a certain amount of time, but eventually these fronts will come into contact and the smaller ones will lose off.
So eventually it detonates and the island will just shrink.
That's right, exactly. So it will shrink. such. It's very much like having soldiers near to each other. The inner ones are always less, of course, than the outer ones. And so therefore the outer ones will win. If you line them all up, there's one more soldier than the outer ones. The difference is only small, it's just one soldier difference. Right? It's like a question of so how much longer does a cable need to be if you line it up, pull it up around the Earth? How much longer does it have to be if you lift it if everybody lifts it up by 2 meters, right? The cable has to be longer by 2 meters only times 2 pi, very small amount. And that's the reason why this diffusion process is so slow. And it just depends on how many of these topologically independent blocks you have. Remarkable, but straightforward factor, of course.
Does the topology make a difference for the use of the
source? I mean, I'm always talking about closed domains. If you have a space that, which is no longer flat, you mean, yeah? This I haven't checked.
Presumably, you want to do this view.
Yeah, that may make a difference, certainly, yes. But probably only a quantitative difference, and eventually it depends on the number of such blocks again that we have. Just a mark.
Are there more questions? Okay. Well, thanks for speaking.
Okay.
Examples of
chiral symmetry
breaking.
Yes. Oh, yeah, you can see crystals, yeah?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, for instance, right? But it could be that the templates that might have used were already.
Yes, that's an idea of harmony, yes, yes. I mean, first of all, there are these, first of all, making molecules, assembling molecules, is much easier on surfaces. Clays has been proposed.
Right, these things are chiral, as far as I know.
They can be chiral, yes. Yeah. And again,